Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. It's hard to imagine a world where we leave future generations with fewer rights and freedoms. Since the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills aimed at blocking people from getting the essential sexual and reproductive care they need, including abortion. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves access to care. And with supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
So have you ever heard of the children's book, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie?
No.
Oh, if you give a mouse a cookie, he'll want some milk to go with it. And then this increasingly demanding mouse, like, keeps getting the poor, you know, second person.
So it's similar in structure to when you give a crazed, crying lowlife a break. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Dara Lind. We are both back from vacation in New England and joined today by Emily Stewart, who covers many things for Vox.com, but lately has been on the Omarosa beat, which I'm sure is what you dreamed of when you got into journalism.
Yeah, well, actually, I really do like reality television, but I miss the whole Apprentice thing, so it's been kind of a journey for me.
So this morning, as I was making some oatmeal for Jose, I saw at 7:31, the president of the United States tweeted, "When you give a crazed, crying lowlife a break and give her a job at the White House, I guess it just didn't work out. Good work by General Kelly for quickly firing that dog." So that's sort of where we are as a country. From context, the dog was Omarosa. And tell us, Emily, like, who is Omarosa and why are we tweeting about her?
Well, Omarosa was a contestant on The Apprentice in 2004. So that's when we met her. And she's kind of been in and out of reality television and the White House and Donald Trump's orbit for the past, I guess, what, 14 years then, which is kind of wild to think about. And she has this new book, Unhinged, that's out today that makes a lot of allegations about her time with Trump and the White House. And she's also been playing recordings that she has of John Kelly and of Donald Trump that she apparently made secretly, and she's playing them on live television.
And it's in the White House, mind you, which raises some questions among some national security experts about the operational information security of this White House, which has never been the most secure thing in the world. It's currently teetering on the brink of, hackable in 10 minutes.
One thing that I think is notable about this, right, is, you know, Omarosa, she came into the White House sort of immediately considered as something of a joke, right? Like, she had been a kind of villain character on reality television. She's African American, and obviously the Trump administration was not making a lot of, like, super sincere efforts at African American outreach. And you know, she came in that context of, like, not having political experience, not having...
She was in the Clinton White House.
Yeah, she worked for the Gore administration.
Yeah,
and at Commerce.
She was working at the Office of Presidential Personnel. Emily and I, between the two of us, have probably read a substantial portion of this book at this point.
So I had it wrong. Okay, but she was actually the most qualified member of the White House staff.
Totally reinforces the point you're making, though, which is that for the entire presidential campaign, basically, when Donald Trump's, you know, flirtations with racism or, like, the fact that he'd come to national prominence as a birther were brought up, one of the go-to replies was, but Omarosa is in a senior campaign position. She's part of Trump's inner circle. He can't be racist. He has a black friend. Of course, the black friend in question was a former Democrat, which, like, did not quell suspicions that Donald Trump was playing with an ideology that no person of color could in good conscience support.
Well, either way. So she serves in the White House for a little bit. She leaves. And then when the first rumors of this book start to come out, I definitely noticed, like, not from Trump zone, but from, like, the White House press corps, you know, like the sort of official Trump whisperers out there, those who have sources and tell us what's really going on. There was a lot of preemptive disdain for this book, right? In an unusual way, right? Like, normally a former senior White House official comes out with a juicy tell-all memoir and people are like, ooh, like, let's get the juice, right? Not necessarily like 100% credulous or like unaware that people have their own motives, but like, this will be interesting. The groundwork was really laid by the people who are on this beat all the time mm-hmm. without having read the book to just like initially say like, okay, none of this is credible. And I was on vacation and as a somewhat witless, credible person myself, I was like, well, all right, this is probably not that credible. And that's where the tapes come in. And
right.
It's striking. I mean, I'm not going to say that the fact that some of the things she says are backed up by audio recordings mean that everything she says is true. But frankly, we like read in journalism a lot of secondhand, off-the-record, dishy scoops from the White House that aren't backed up by the kind of hard evidence
right.
that she's providing here.
And specifically the line, you know, the skeptical line on her book was leading with the fact that she wasn't having it fact-checked in a typical way. And, like, it's always hard to fact-check books like this because essentially you have to get, you know, you're getting people to attest, yes, I heard this thing. That's not necessarily helpful. But it did kind of make it seem plausible that she was just kind of making things up out of thin air. And if apparently there is documentary evidence to back some of it up, the idea that she wasn't having it fact-checked kind of loses a lot of its importance.
Right.
Of the last several hours of kind of Omarosa immersion, what's kind of the stuff that stuck out to you as the wildest? We'll put it that way.
I mean, the wildest, I don't know. I mean, you know, we've seen a lot about that she alleges that he's used the N-word on these Apprentice tapes. At first, she said she had not seen or she hadn't heard the audio, but now she says that she has heard the audio. And then last night, the president tweeted out that Mark Burnett told him that there was no tapes, which wouldn't he know whether or not they were tapes? Like, he should know whether or not he says that. She says that the president was in mental decline, that she actually discovered that while watching him in that infamous Lester Holt interview where he was talking about the Russia thing and that's why he fired Comey. She says that's when she figured out there was some sort of a problem and that everyone ignored her. I mean, she's making a lot of allegations. She talks about Trump calling Betsy DeVos Ditsy DeVos.
But I would say, I mean, again, to give credit where I think, frankly, more credit is due than she was given by the people who do this professionally. She has been responsible for breaking a major news story about the use of non-disclosure agreements
right.
in the White
yes,
House.
Yes, that is true.
Right? Yeah. Like, this is a huge scoop that, like, all the people who were shitting on her book didn't get, right? Which is that, like, there had long been rumors that Trump was trying to make government employees sign the type of restrictive non-disclosure agreements that he used in his private companies. The White House had always denied that that was true. I think the denials always seemed a little bit plausible because it would be illegal to have government employees sign those kind of non-disclosure agreements.
Yeah, but there are gradations of rumors in the Trump administration, and this was not one of those rumors that let's put it this way. On the spectrum from, like, every beat reporter on Twitter is putting heavy-handed hints on Twitter
yes,
that this
yes.
is true to their, you know, everybody trusts the things the White House says and reports them without
yeah,
any
yeah,
context.
Yeah.
Like, this was closer to the first end
sure.
of that.
But, I mean, we now have it out there, right, that, like, they definitely were having people sign non-disclosure agreements, that the way they were addressing the apparent illegality of this is that the White House counsel was advising people that they shouldn't worry about signing it because it was illegal and so it wouldn't be enforceable. And I think this is where we're ultimately going. This is a very strange way to run your operation.
Right.
Right? To have one person be like, sign this paper. And then when you're like, I don't really want to sign the paper, have somebody else being like, don't worry, the paper's illegal. So that's why you should do it. And that they are seemingly keeping some former staffers on retainer at these sort of para-campaign roles for fairly high salaries as kind of hush money, which again is something that had been out there in the ether. I mean, I think it had seemed like the former bodyguard in particular was on a deal like that. But it's really been confirmed as a result of this book where, again, I mean, I can tell from last week's reaction that like the press corps is going to be disinclined to give her credit for like bringing to light meaningful things that it's in the public interest to know. But it seems to me that like whatever else happens with secret, you know, apprentice tapes or whatever else, like, you know, this is an important part of the architecture of the Trump White House.
So I think it's worth kind of going a little bit deeper into the past to talk about why Omarosa was getting such preemptive pushback from B reporters who are, you know, well looped in with current officials in the Trump White House. Yes. About a year ago, when John Kelly replaced Rince Priebus as chief of staff, there was a wave of stories about how John Kelly is finally restoring discipline to the chaotic Trump White House. And between the things where people weren't named but were hinted and the fact that Omarosa was one of the only people who was consistently named in these stories, it was clear that when they meant people who had just kind of taken a personal vendetta-based approach to the White House, who were treating it as their personal fiefdom, like Omarosa was very high on that list. She was accused of just barging into a bunch of meetings where she wasn't invited. She was accused of just piling her shoes under her desk and walking around without shoes on. It was this weird mix of like petty gossip and, well, we know that the Trump White House hasn't been working well, and Omarosa is part of the problem. And of course, she was, you know, sidelined soon after John Kelly got in and formally left the White House ultimately after that. But the sense of Omarosa that we get from the book is that she was one of the only people in the room who actually cared about Donald Trump's campaign promises. And she took it as her personal mission to, like, make sure that Donald Trump was doing the things for the American people, specifically people of color, that he had said he would, in a world full of Trump administration officials who had their own personal interests at heart. And honestly, both of these things can be true, right? Omarosa can certainly have been less than professional in the way she navigated the White House, but it's also really hard after a year of John Kelly to look back at what he was doing at the outset and that wave of stories that were clearly, you know, somebody in the White House was telling reporters that Omarosa was the problem, and to say, oh, yeah, what John Kelly and the New Guard wanted was just to restore serious policymaking to the Trump presidency.
Right. Okay, so secret tapes. What is on these tapes that Omarosa's played on television?
So we've heard a couple so far. We heard John Kelly firing her from inside of the Situation Room, just telling her that she had to go. And then we heard Trump calling her after she was fired, asking, you know, what happened? Are you okay? There are also reportedly tapes of Ivanka and Jared talking to her, which I would actually be interesting to hear sort of what they sound like not when they're doing their public show. And so that's sort of what's on the tapes thus far. Honestly, do they exist? Do they not? So to a certain extent, you also have to wonder, like, at this point, does it matter? Do we need to ask, like, what does Trump think about Black people and Latinos? Like, are we sure he's a little bit racist? Like, if we do find these secret tapes, okay. Like, we also have tapes of him talking about grabbing women by the pussy, and that didn't matter either. So I just feel like at the end of the day, I don't know whether or not this will matter. I mean, I think it's interesting to see Omarosa, who's someone who has been in his orbit for a long time, and as much as she's not maybe the best person in the world or whatever value judgment you want to make, it comes across to me in the book that she does genuinely sort of care about him. And if you actually listen to the audio of her conversation with Trump that came out yesterday, and she put out like a very short clip of him just being like, Omarosa, Omarosa, like, are you okay? What happened? And it does sound like there's some sort of genuine affinity between the two of them.
Yes.
And whatever you think about that, they do have an actual relationship. And I don't know, you think about all the people around him in the White House. I don't think they're the best of friends, but maybe she does care and he kind of cared about her at some point.
So we have that tape that's been played. She's made the tape of John Kelly firing her available. And then this morning there was a tape of a conversation that she talks about in the book during the campaign where Katrina Pearson, who was a spokesperson, says that she, Katrina, has heard from someone else that Frank Luntz had heard the tape of Trump using the N-word on The Apprentice. But, like, there are other tapes that she claims to have, right? There's that level, and then there's the level of tapes like the N-word tape that she doesn't claim to have accessible, but she is portraying herself as someone reliable saying it exists.
Basically, she has released a tape of Trump aides discussing
right.
their belief in yes. the existence of this Apprentice tape
yes.
that Trump says does not exist. What's suspicious about it is that Trump says Mark Burnett says it doesn't exist, but Mark Burnett has not said that.
Right. Yeah. Mark Burnett is only agreeing to interviews if he's not asked about Trump.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
which is a little bit suspicious. And I think it speaks to some of the larger issues here, right? Because, like, Mark Burnett is clearly trying to help Donald Trump out, right? At the same time, Mark Burnett seems to be trying to hedge, right? Like, he is not going out there and saying these things under his own name. He's preventing anybody from seeing what is in these tapes. He's letting Trump make representations about what he has told him, but he's personally keeping his sort of hands off of it. And that's like just a very predominant theme in the larger Trump universe, is that everybody is always sort of watching, you know, on like a big ocean-going ship, you know, you have like different doors where you can shut down compartments in case the ship starts flooding. Right? Everybody is mindful of that kind of thing, right? Like, there's a lot of people who seem very aware that this whole thing may go down catastrophically. And, like, they want to make sure that, like, they have their own life rafts or, like, ways to prevent themselves from getting drowned. And for Omarosa, like, her personal version of that seems to have been secretly recording her colleagues in the White House.
Right. But I want to talk about this because Omarosa appears not to have been the only one doing that. There was a story at some point in the last several months from The Times where they reported that, you know, several White House staffers were concerned that one of their colleagues was secretly recording them. Maggie Haberman has now come forward and said that wasn't Omarosa who was being talked about there.
Right.
And other reporters have now said that, you know, there's this kind of people who have existing vendettas against their White House colleagues are now trying to sow suspicion by saying, oh, that's the person who's, you know, that person's been taping me. It's despite the non-disclosure agreements, this continues to be the most disclosureful administration in history inadvertently. And I think the compartments model is super useful because many of them appear to be willing to try to protect the president, but they're also protecting themselves here, right? Like, Omarosa has clearly given up on protecting the president and has no love for a lot of other people in the White House. But even current White House staffers appear to be, and, you know, we've read these stories about how a lot of people are getting very tired of working in the White House. You know, they're worried about leaving because they're worried they won't be able to find good jobs. It's worth thinking about the kind of reception to this book as a lot of people who are deeply concerned that they've tanked their careers by tying themselves to an administration that is somewhere between chaotic and criminal, depending on who you're talking about, and trying to spin themselves as the hero who tried to stop things or someone who wasn't aware of what was going on. It's not clear that it's working yet, right? Like, what is Omarosa doing at this point?
I mean, to me, when you look at everybody who's gone to the administration, Omarosa makes the most sense. She's been on reality television forever. She leaves. She's immediately on Celebrity Big Brother. Like, obviously, she was doing this.
Sure.
Obviously, she saw a career after this. The bigger questions for me are like, okay, a Gary Cohn. What were you doing? What did you have to get out of this? Like, Wilbur Ross, if you knew that you were grifting from people, if you knew you were lying about a billionaire, you already had all of this money, why go into the administration? And so, I don't know, for me, Omarosa, like, this makes complete sense before, during, and after exactly what she's done compared to everyone else who's really gone in there. You know, if you're somebody who's had, like, just a regular political career, yeah, like, you don't know what comes next. But for Omarosa, like, yeah, obviously, all of this comes next.
Right. It's everything that she's been doing for 15 years now, right? It's like getting attention, getting on television, moving on to the next thing, right? And that's up to and including, right? I mean, I think the recording of her conversation with John Kelly, where he fires her, is not that interesting in terms of what he says, but it's very intriguing, right? Because this happens in the White House Situation Room, right? And there's like two elements. One is like to have a recording device in the Situation Room is a bizarre breach of protocol. And I don't understand how it happened. I have not been in the Situation Room, but I have been in secure rooms in the White House for meetings. And what happens when you go into a secure room these days, because nowadays everybody carries around with them all the time recording devices in the form of their phones. So it's not like, you know, in the 80s, if you'd like asked someone like, do you have a recording device in your pocket? That would have been like a weirdly hostile thing to ask. But like today, like everybody all the time has recording devices. So all the time outside of a secure room, there is an aide who's like, you have to put your phones in this box, right? Because it's normal to be carrying phones. So if there's a place where you can't have phones, it's normal to have a procedure where you can't bring your phones in there. And I don't know how that could possibly have broken down over the most secure room in the White House when it applies to just like all kinds of random little conference rooms in the basement there.
I mean, you're using the present tense here, and like I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I certainly haven't been in any White House or executive office building since the inauguration of President Trump. And I wouldn't be surprised if that norm had broken down substantially, not least because John Kelly had to put out a memo several months ago trying to restrict the use of cell phones.
No, I understand. But it's one of these things where I'm just not fully imagining how this came about. And then the secondary question of why was the chief of staff who has an office – like, why was he holding a one-on-one meeting?
In the Situation Room.
Like, it's very puzzling. And who knows? I mean, maybe he's just really bad at planning his day. But it seemed to me to suggest that he was trying to get away from either the president or what he believes to be surveillance inside his own office.
Well, but if you read, I don't know who had a story about it when she was fired, maybe not sure who, but saying that she was trying to like storm the president's office. So if this is real, then that makes sense that they take her into there. And in terms of her phone, like maybe I'm thinking about this wrong, but she probably just stuck it in her pocket or whatever and walked in with it. Like, isn't it voluntary to give up your phone? Like, are they checking you? I don't know.
I just
they are. It's like you have the lockbox and you put the phone in the lockbox and then you go in.
And you could imagine something else, right? Where it's like if I had wanted to like sneak a recording in, what I would do is have something that wasn't my phone. So then I'd be like, hey, here's my phone. And then people being who they are, they're like not going to pat you down because they know who you are. But anyway, it's sort of a minor detail. But along with the like constant misspellings in official press releases and stuff, it's like a reminder that like something has gone just like wrong.
Right.
I mean, in like the basic detail work here.
I mean, it's also kind of the fundamental judgment call level, right? Because like the White House response to Omarosa right now is, one, without acknowledging it, that she's breaking the terms of the NDA that they refused to acknowledge existed and that is illegal to require people to sign, and two, that she shouldn't have been recording in the Situation Room, which is entirely true and accurate, but also, you know, not only were they not checking it, but they clearly were running a situation where that was possible. They made the decision to hire Omarosa. They made the decision to hire these other people who created this environment that she talks about. You know, they made the decision to hire whichever other unknown current White House staffer is also engaging in taping within the White House. Clearly, this is not just an Omarosa problem. And so, you know, when Donald Trump gets on Twitter and talks about how crazy Omarosa is and in the same breath talks about how useless Jeff Sessions is as an attorney general, the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump hired these people. And actually, with regards to Omarosa in particular, as the buzz around the book built, in the midst of a current White House, a current or former White House staffer, I don't remember, talking about how unreliable she was, a reporter said, well, but you guys hired her. And the response was, no, POTUS hired her. Like, okay, A, if you're a White House aide and your response is, no, 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 I'm passing the buck to the president, that doesn't inspire a ton of confidence. But also, the problems that Donald Trump has identified with his White House are problems of Donald Trump's making in 9 cases out of 10, and this is one of the 9.
All right, let's take a break and talk about some broader issues here.
Support for this podcast comes from Planned Parenthood. Your body is your own. That's why Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Today, lawmakers who oppose abortion are challenging Planned Parenthood. Affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. Planned Parenthood believes that health care is a basic human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common-sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies. They also work tirelessly to oppose the onslaught of new policies aimed at interfering with personal decisions best left to patients and their doctors. They won't give up, and they won't back down. You can join Planned Parenthood in the fight to help make sure that the next generation can decide their own futures. The organization needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, they can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future to learn more and support their cause.
Support for The Weeds comes from Burrow. Okay, are you ready for the understatement of the century? Buying furniture can be frustrating. You end up visiting a bunch of stores searching aimlessly for the right pieces to match your home, then spend hours trying to get those pieces together, or together again if you got it wrong the first time. And that's even if you were able to get it through the door. Burrow is a furniture company that wants to make the whole thing easier. Burrow's new Dune line features a contemporary yet timeless look inspired by the craftsmanship of classic mid-century construction. If you're looking to bring a sense of luxury, comfort, and durability to your outdoor spaces, you might want to consider Burrow. Like all of Burrow's pieces, they offer easy assembly and disassembly so you can move or store them away as needed. Not only that, they ship straight to your door for free. Listeners of The Weeds can get 15% off their first order at burrow.com/weeds. That's Burrow, BURROW.com/weeds for 15% off. Burrow.com/weeds.
So I actually kind of want to ask, Emily, as far as kind of the rest of the people in the White House are concerned, do you think that anything either in the book or in the kind of broader foo-for-all around this, do you think we've kind of gotten any insight into some of the other personalities or the White House in general?
There are a couple of places in the book, and I think both sections that you and I have read, where he does call Donald Trump Jr. a fuck-up, which is a little bit just disappointing for Donald Trump Jr. I think that, you know, it's hard to glean from her sort of book and the way she talks about herself, because she does really sell it as, like, I was the one person in the entire White House who saw what was going on and knew everything that was happening. So it's hard to know, like, as much as there are maybe, like, fun tidbits or things like that, I don't know if there's some grander story, because obviously she's telling us the story she wants to tell, and the story is, I'm Omarosa, the heroine of everything.
So my understanding of reality shows is kind of figuring out, you know, doing this reverse engineering of moving past the editing is, you know, a pretty well-established pastime of people who watch it, right? So, like, assuming that Omarosa is giving herself the hero edit, is this even possible to read as a reality show? Or is it because it's a book and there's no first-person documentary footage in here, there is not as much you can glean about, oh, even Omarosa can't disguise this thing?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that.
But, you know, so here's the thing. I'm struck by, in all the sort of rancor and people dropping out and various different memoirs, that it's not really true. But somebody should tell the story that what happened was that Donald Trump entered the White House with all of this promise to be this, like, new disruptive force who was going to take down the elites and change Washington. But then he was sabotaged by the political establishment who stopped him from doing his billion-dollar infrastructure plan and a million other things and got him on board with Paul Ryan's stupid healthcare repeal. And, like, that's where it all went wrong. And that, like, I believed in Donald Trump and Donald Trump's ideas and the ideas that, like, won him the primary and won him the election after everyone had abandoned him. And it's unfortunate that, like, vulnerable and a little bit insecure as a new president, like, he chose to rely too much on these, like, Washington regulars who didn't stay true to his vision. Like, that's the story that I would pitch because, you know, it has some elements of truth to it and makes some kind of sense of things, whereas this kind of account that it's like, well, there's just a bunch of jerks there, and the president is in mental decline. Like, what does that mean? Like, why was she working there in the first place? Like, what did she think was going to happen?
I mean, this is kind of where the "I was the only one committed to the vision" thing comes in, right? Her account of the transition is she wanted to get hired to run the head of the Office of Public Liaison and had a couple of very contentious interviews with Rince Priebus, where Priebus was like, "What do you know about coalition building, yada, yada, yada?" And ultimately, she says she found out that Anthony Scaramucci was very deep in discussions to become head of the Office of Public Liaison. And, like, Anthony Scaramucci is not a Washington insider swamp creature. He is not more qualified than Omarosa.
Scaramucci couldn't sell his hedge fund. That was why he didn't get the job.
Right. But, like, the argument for hiring Scaramucci over Omarosa was not exactly, oh, this is a person who knows how the White House works, right? So the way that she's presenting it is that she had this grassroots, authentic connection to early Trump, to the things that Trump was saying on the trail, to the African-American community. And she was trying to stick around to make sure that, you know, the things Donald Trump had said about wanting to represent all of America actually panned out. Like, that's a narrative that I can believe, frankly, both because people do a lot of work to tell themselves that what they're doing is noble, like a lot of work, and because, frankly, in an administration that has a lot of trouble hiring people, like both at the White House level and below, you know, she's got stories in here about, like, she was trying to find resumes for, like, qualified executive branch appointees of color, and a lot of the resumes were, like, fake names or, like, had mean jokes about the president in them. Like, I can imagine, yeah, it's going to be really hard to find enough applicants of color to work in the Trump White House.
Sure.
So, you know, that logic is also something that I've heard from people elsewhere in the executive branch, is the kind of, you're always doing the work of figuring out, okay, are the things I'm being asked to do and the people I'm working with worse than what would happen if I went away and somebody else were in my stead?
But how many times now have we had this, like, cycle where the White House tries to tell us that we can't believe the stories being told by this former Trump associate because it's like a crook and a liar, right? So it's like Michael Cohen, right? Nobody would believe a shady con man like that. Rick Gates, clearly a thief and a liar. That's the deputy campaign manager. You know, Omarosa was, again, high-ranking assistant to the president. Like, she's a dog. And we've had a number of other unflattering terms.
Low life.
Yeah. It's a shame for Donald Trump that he was forced to staff his White House with so many crooks and liars and to let Michael Wolff run around there all this time. Trump says that he doesn't have a real attorney general separately, but, you know, this is an ongoing kind of feud. And it's great reality television, but it's like, it's really crazy. You know, there's a complete abdication of responsibility for anything here, right? In, like, Trump's discourse about himself and the White House's larger discourse, like, nobody is saying that, like, I mean, of course, you don't expect anything from Trump at this point, but, like, he made decisions. It's okay in life to make some decisions that don't work out, but, like, that's on you.
Well, and that's actually why the, like, hearing, your take on the Trump Omarosa tape, Emily, that there's clearly, like, or at least was at that point, some affection left there is maybe even all the more worrisome, because it's really, really hard to square that with what he's saying about Omarosa now. And, like, we know that Donald Trump has a really fraught relationship with loyalty, but this was someone who, like, had demonstrated a certain amount of ability to stick around in the inner circle. So has Donald Trump just thrown Omarosa over and is now committed to assassinating her character? Or is there some personal, you know, affection for her there that is getting bracketed off so that they can engage in a character assassination campaign?
Well, I think that you have to remember that Trump has fired Omarosa multiple times in the past several years. And so I think for me, it's part of it is just the continuing Trump Omarosa show. You know, he fired her in 2004 and then brought her back to Celebrity Apprentice or whatever. You know, he brings her into the White House. He fires her again. Who knows if in a year, 2 years, she will be back in Trump's orbit. I wouldn't discount that at all. I don't know with Michael Cohen, the relationship at this point is a little more fraught probably, but with Omarosa, like, fine. She leaves, she writes her book, she does whatever. Who knows if in a year, 2 years, she's not back on the campaign trail. I mean, when we talk about the NDA, you know, they offered her an NDA and a job on the Trump 2020 campaign after she was fired. Like, and it's probably just to get her to sign the non-disclosure agreement. But still, they were still like, Omarosa, come back for Trump 2020. And that says something. Like, she's not going to probably disappear from Trump's orbit, I would guess.
So it's not just, oh, you leave and we'll slime you as a liar. It's we'll slime you as a liar as you come back to the fold, at which point we'll just assume that everyone's forgotten about it?
I mean, maybe. Who knows? Like, I mean, look at how Scaramucci left. And now he's sort of back around and sort of defending the president in weird ways. You know, Sean Spicer didn't leave in the happiest of terms, and he describes Trump as a unicorn. Like, I wouldn't – it's not right. Like a forever done sort of deal with Trump a lot of the time.
Right. It makes it absolutely impossible not only to – believe in any individual thing the White House says, but even to figure out why they're saying it, right? Like, they're clearly on defense for this particular news cycle on Omarosa. Do they have a greater strategy beyond that? Are they thinking about, like, do they think this is a serious political liability for them? Do they think it's a serious legal liability for them? There are some times when you can actually tell what they're playing defense against, and this is not one of them because it's so, the lies are so tangled that you can't even figure out the meta-truths there.
I mean, it appears to me that I don't know that you want to call this a strategy, right? But like Trump's impulse, right, which is an impulse that he inherits from several careers ago, is to ride waves of attention and attempt to master them. Right? Like he never believes that he should let something blow over. Right? So like if something is coming that is getting attention, he wants to inject himself into it and generate even more attention and make sure that his take on the thing also gets a lot of attention. And he is successfully doing that. Like, we all really know what Donald Trump thinks about Omarosa.
Or at least what he purports to.
But like the Obama administration, right? Obviously, this exact situation would not have arisen, but like in general, right? Like a controversy that was not substantively important, that involved a person who the White House regarded as not credible and not one of theirs, and who even professional political reporters were not that inclined to take super seriously, they would have tried to just be dismissive of and move on and be like, what you really should be talking about is our advanced battery manufacturing, right? And like the president himself would never address it. You know, they'd put out like the third deputy press secretary to be dismissive, right? And like that is not Trump, right? Like Trump wants to like grab the electric wire of attention and like make sure you get his spin on it. And I would be hard pressed to call that like a really good strategy for being president, but it's like it's clearly what he does. Right? A little bit without regard to whether the underlying issue – some people will be like, well, he's like distracting us from like what I think would be a good political message. But like he's also distracting us from what his own team thinks would be a good political message. Whatever their midterm strategy is, like it was not this.
Right. This brings me back to the compartment theory, which I think is the kind of boat compartment simile you came up with earlier in the episode, because I think it's actually really – it's a useful way to think about it because so many people in the White House appear to believe that this is about taking on water and they're trying to prevent themselves from getting swept under. But, you know, given the president's impulsivity, not just on messaging, but on policy, you know, the reports that while he's in Bedminster or in Mar-a-Lago, he'll like come back and say, oh, a member really wants me to look into this. You should take care of it. That not only is there this danger that any given person in the White House is going to be tainted by the overall chaos of the White House, but what do they have to show for being in the White House? What are they actually doing? That's not necessarily something in their control when the president can just, like, dictate the agenda based on what he's heard from Sean Hannity or some, you know, Mar-a-Lago member. And it appears to be that they are currently spending more time trying to protect themselves from their colleagues in the White House by, you know, engaging in retaliatory leaks to reporters, by taping all that kind of thing, than actually doing the current job. It is not at all clear whether anyone in the White House is actually putting together a record that they could be proud of, you know, even if Donald Trump weren't there. And furthermore, the more that we get this kind of pervasive atmosphere of paranoia in the White House, like, which I'm sure now that we actually have tapes that have come out will increase, the more times we're going to go through this, right? You can't Omarosa everybody. There are going to be people who are going to feel that they have nothing to lose by talking about what they know.
Maybe. Which, one thing that's striking to me is actually how few people are there. Like, at all? Particularly when you consider that, like, Mick Mulvaney, right, who theoretically holds a very senior White House policymaking job, he seems to have, in practice, skedaddled across the street and is, like, working full-time at his second job, running the – what is he calling it now?
The BFCP or the BCFB. He switched around the acronym.
Right. It used to be the CFPB. It's now the –
the Bureau of Consumer Finance Protection.
Right. Yeah. But anyway, so he's the OMB director, right? So this is like a big job. But I don't want to say he's not doing the job, but not a lot is coming out of that office. Whereas
– well, I think that's the point that of Mick Mulvaney at the CFPB is that there is not a lot coming out. But that's the thing where we're not looking at what Mick Mulvaney's doing because we're looking at the Omarosa show.
Yes, right. But this is something I remember like way back in the – early months. It wasn't transition. Trump was president, but things were not fully staffed up. And I was talking to a right of center think tank guys, and they were saying that it was a weird situation because people wanted to work in the administration, as Republicans will when there's a Republican administration, but they were a little leery of working in the White House because they didn't want to end up buried in subpoenas and like endless legal bills. So it was
and they didn't want to sign an illegal NDA.
Well, that wasn't look, I wish I had that script. That's not what I was told. But that it was a little bit of an inversion of the typical process where like normally you want to be close to the center of power. And even though like cabinet secretaries are important people, being like aides to cabinet secretaries is a little like low class compared to working in the White House. And these guys were saying to me, and I think it's been borne out, that like this is different, that like if you are a Republican policy person, like what you want to do is go work in an agency that deals with an issue you care about and like focus on that and like try not to know anything about the White House and like just do your thing. And I do think, Scott Pruitt aside, you know, a lot of that has worked out, right? There are any number of assistant secretaries and, you know, Schedule C aides and stuff plugging away in the federal government, you know, deregulating or just not regulating and not like swept up in this reality show.
Yeah. I mean, I think it varies tremendously by department, right? If you're at Commerce, you really are having to spend a lot of your time dealing with Donald Trump's and Donald Trump and Peter Navarro's trade war. If you're at Justice, like the fact that there is an ongoing public attempt to influence the investigations that your department does and doesn't pursue. You know, if you're at State and you've had to deal with two secretaries, one attempted reorg, the kind of broader problems that Donald Trump carries with him in not talking to diplomats. like it's, you know, there are places where in the absence of direction, you can do a lot. There are places where in the absence of direction, you can't do much. And there are places that are being actively, you know, controlled directly or indirectly by what the president or people in the White House want to do. And I think that, you know, if there's any kind of lesson from the Omarosa Mishegas at the organizational and policy level, it's just how exhausting it appears to be to engage in all this interpersonal drama. Like, the more people on the executive branch org chart who are spending all of their time doing this stuff, the less capacity there is to even attempt to build a working, functioning executive branch.
Yep. that about sums it up. So thank you, Emily, for joining us. We're going to take another break, and Darren and I are going to come back and talk about a white paper.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity. But giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team. Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Eurovision is here. This year's contest gets underway this week in Malmö, Sweden. But this year's contest comes with a dose of controversy. I'll give you one guess as to what people are mad about. Yes, correct. It's that.
Organizers of the Eurovision Song Contest say they are assessing whether Israel's entry breaks the rules on political neutrality.
I think it's a shame. I think there is no way that Israel should be able to participate.
Pro-Palestinian protesters are taking to the Swedish streets. More than 1,000 Swedish artists, including Robin, have called for an Israel ban. Some European politicians are joining them. Charlie Harding from Switched On Pop joins us this week on Today Explained to help us figure out if Europe can sing its way out of this situation.
So, unfortunately, we could not find an Omarosa-relevant white paper for this week. That's kind of a lie. We didn't exactly try. But there's some fun findings on the effects of unemployment and temporary employment on spouses' well-being. This is a paper in the American Sociological Review, the, I believe, most recent issue of the American Sociological Review, and it's by Hande Inanch of Mathematical Policy Research. And she's looking through about almost 20 years of data from Britain from a multi-wave survey of households that they did, asking people, you know, how satisfied they were with their lives, and also for a bunch of, you know, information about their what she calls subjective well-being. Are you sleeping well? How are you, you know, how are you feeling day to day? That kind of thing. The theory that she's building on here is that there is an existing literature showing that obviously people don't feel as happy or as good about themselves when they're not employed. Like, that's fairly well established. But when you are looking at married couples generally, having an unemployed husband really does a number on the well-being of wives. But having an unemployed wife does not have as substantial or really much of an impact at all on the well-being of husbands. There's this marked gender difference in that, which, you know, you could extrapolate to say a lot about the gender role of breadwinner and how much more of an impact that has when it's a man who is kind of failing to live up to the expectations set for him by society rather than a woman who has the alternative position of homemaker, et cetera. So she's expanding kind of this known thing to look at temporary employment as well. And what she finds is that unlike unemployment, where there really is this stark gender difference, having a temporarily employed spouse has about the same negative effects on the well-being of both husbands whose wives are temporarily employed and wives whose husbands are temporarily employed. It doesn't have the kind of marked gender differences. Right. There are kind of a lot of nuances in this, but the upshot is that temporary employment is kind of seen as a stressor in both cases. And it's not something that is just reducible to the financial hardship. It's something that appears to kind of have psychic impact on how people see not only their own lives, but the lives of the other people in their household.
One of the things that's interesting about this is that it sheds light on what is going on with the gender difference in reaction to mm-hmm. unemployment, right? Where if you look at it, right, I mean, the basic story there, right, is like, unemployed husband is unhappy and his wife is also unhappy. It's like unemployed wife may be unhappy. But the husband is not necessarily unhappy, right?
Yes.
Like she is presumably doing stuff around the house or whatever. He doesn't care. You know, it's fine. You could construe like what the issue is there in a number of different ways. The fact that it doesn't carry over to the temporary employment situation, right? It shows that the I think it shows that the affirmative value that is placed on a woman doing the homemaker role is high, right? That the temporary work does not convey like the full status and security of a full-time job. This is in the British context where these are like formal regulatory categories.
Right.
But it keeps you out of the house. So you are not like performing the role of homemaker while you're on this temporary employment contract, right? And so it's like the inability to do that, right, like creates a void, right?
Yes.
Whereas it was sort of ambiguous, right? I mean, like we understand what gender roles are and how it plays into this, but looking at the temporary employment helps us see like exactly what it is. And it's that like actually an unemployed woman can and typically does like step into a socially understood role, which is the role of the full-time homemaker, right? And like her husband typically feels okay about that. Whereas with the temporary work, it disrupts that, right? You are not fulfilling the dream of whatever is like normative employment in Britain, but also not this other thing.
But here's where it gets really wild is so for husbands, the ranking basically goes, you have an unemployed wife or an employed wife and you're okay. You have a temporarily employed wife and you're doing less well. For wives, their assessment of their own happiness with their employment situation is they're least happy when they're unemployed, next most happy when they're fully employed, and happiest when they're temporarily employed. So
right.
Like this huge discrepancy between wives' perceptions of their own well-being and husbands' perceptions of their well-being based on the wife's employment status that doesn't work for husbands. And there are a couple of ways that you can think about that. One is that wives are, you know, socially conditioned to be more attuned to the well-being of their husband and to think of that as like the important thing for their family, and husbands are less so for their wives. The other is that when women are temporarily employed, that may be for them an opportunity to kind of to have it all, to be doing work around the house as well as having, you know, some kind of contribution to the household, that is something that a wife doesn't necessarily see as a stressor, but that the husband not only doesn't see as like the wife fulfilling her role, but isn't being super receptive to the fact that the wife appears to be happier about that. Like, this is kind of, I think, what this paper raises for me is even though generally couples' well-being varies with each other and has an impact on each other, there really does appear to be this persistent difference between how wives think of their own happiness and how husbands think of their own happiness when the wife and husband have different employment situations.
Yes. Now, I wish this had talked explicitly about children because obviously many married couples have school age or younger children at home, but many also do not. And that sort of seems like a relevant parameter in many of these discussions about employment and temporary employment and what it is you are doing here. And I wonder, you know, how different that looks if you see a bigger or different or whatever it is, impact in families with young kids present versus other kinds of married couples, because, well, I don't know, I feel like it's obvious why it should make a difference. But, you know, I mean, taking care of children is difficult. It is work that many people do as paid professional stuff, but it's also enjoyable and something that people find fulfilling and is like a particularly sort of like high form of the traditional homemaker role.
Right.
And it seems like intuitive to me, at least, that that might make a big difference in terms of like what is it we're saying we're doing at this point as a family. You know, one thing that I've seen from other research that is relevant to this is that there's a big difference, and this is in U.S. data, in what unemployed husbands versus unemployed wives actually do with their time.
Yes.
Right? And so unemployed wives tend to do a lot of caretaking work, whether that's for children or for elders or other relatives, something like that, right? So typically, a woman who is not doing paid work is doing work that, were she not doing it, somebody else would be paid to do, right? Whereas unemployed men do a little bit more care work than employed men, but really not much more, and in principle sleep more and watch more television.
Right.
Which, on the one hand, like, it sounds like a kind of like a sweet vacation, but also you see very clearly that like unemployed men are not happy.
Right, right. But at the same time, kind of that becomes super relevant when looking at the kind of existing data that unemployed men whose spouses are also unemployed are less unhappy.
Yes.
And this is something that's borne out in this as well. You know, the author says, unemployed men partnered with unemployed women are significantly more satisfied with their lives compared to being partnered with women in permanent jobs. Like, there's a very persistent dynamic here of, you know, even though you would normally expect the kind of financial stress
right.
of both partners being unemployed to kind of spill over, that's not really what's going on here. What appears to be going on is this idea that female and male unemployment appear to be pretty distinct phenomena within
right.
a household.
But I mean, it's just, I think, like, worth underscoring exactly how dysfunctional the, like, masculine identity becomes in these
right.
unemployed contexts, right? So, like, unemployed men are less useful to other people than unemployed wives, but they are also less happy.
Right.
Right? So, like, they're not, like, taking it easy in a way that they enjoy.
Right.
They're doing nothing useful and they're feeling bad about it. And then they become less unhappy if their wife is also unemployed and the family is strictly worse off just because their relative status is not impugned as much. And all of that is, like, you can understand how that comes about, but, like, that's really bad. That is, like, a bad way to live your life,
right?
Is, like, out of work, not helping other people in your family, feeling bad about yourself, and in some, like, implicit level, like, hoping your wife also loses her job. Like, that's not good, right? Like, people really need some help, some, like, soul repair, I think, is, like, the only real takeaway that,
right.
like, I mean, this is some of it, you know, like, labor market, like, it's like unemployment is really bad, especially for men psychologically. Like, we should, like, work as a society to make it so that people can have jobs. But this is, like, a really unhealthy relationship that men have with their own time use is, like, glaring all over this paper.
Right. And this is at least somewhat independent of self-reported gender role ideology is the other thing here. Like, in general, women in particular with a more egalitarian ideology of, like, who should be responsible for what tend to be less happy. There does not appear to be that. But men do not appear to be more okay with their situation if their gender roles are being disrupted, if they report that they're more egalitarian. And this is pretty consistent with other things we've seen about how even men who claim to be more egalitarian in their ideology often, you know, are still not doing their share of housework. They're not actually stepping up in the home. This is to say that whatever kind of soul repair Matt's talking about can't just be consciousness raising of talking about how, you know, screwed up it is that men are happier when their spouses are in a more precarious economic situation.
Well, I mean, I don't know really what I mean by soul repair, but that's why I use that word.
Yeah,
right? Like,
yeah.
It's something that is operating, like, not at the level of, like, explicit views about how the world should be, right? That, like, people who, like, ascribe to the idea that, like, there should not be starkly gendered division of labor, like, that doesn't change the dynamic here, right? Like, people are clearly on an emotional level, like, bought in, men, to a starkly gendered division of labor, regardless of what their, like, official view is. And, like, it's not great. I think, and in a lot of ways, right, it's almost the reverse. Like, it would be a better world if there was, like, less ascriptive egalitarianism, but more just, like, emotional level
work.
Pragmatism.
Right.
That it's like, look, regardless of how I think it should be, like, the situation that we have is what it is. So I'm going to go do the most useful thing I can do, and I'm going to feel okay about it. Right,
yeah.
would be better than, like, being like, officially, I think this is fine, but, like, in practice, I'm miserable and not doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I actually kind of do wonder this data, A, it's British, and B, it ends in 2008. And I do wonder somewhat if we had more data from the Great Recession, which was kind of purported to have these hugely disparate gender impacts and called the man session and all that kind of stuff, but which did, I think, at least temporarily adjust people's expectations of what they should be doing downward because they felt that everyone was doing badly. I do wonder if you'd see a little bit more acceptance of people's lot there. I wonder if, to a certain extent, this is the function of being told that everyone is doing well or everyone at least can be doing well and you personally are not, that I think does appear to kind of go away in times when empirically everyone is doing badly. Of course, we're now back in a situation where people think that the economy is doing great and they're miserable, so.
Ugh, those man session trend pieces were terrible. That's going to be a segment for another day.
All right.
Suffice it to say, men's employment is more cyclical than women's because more men work in construction and more women work in healthcare, and people don't lay off nurses the same way they lay off carpenters.
Yeah, I think the lesson here is that men's perception of their success and well-being is maybe less tied to economic reality than generally it should be.
Ah, yes. Okay. And with that, you know, our economic reality is that you should spread the love of the Weeds to all your friends, your family, your social media followers, etc. You should check out our Weeds Facebook group where we can continue the discussion, suggest other ideas, suggest other white papers, many more glorious things. I want to thank Emily for joining us earlier, our engineer, Griffin Tanner, our producer, Bridget Armstrong, and we will be back on Friday.